Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. In this episode, we're talking about the ninth leader of the Mali Empire, Mansa Musa. And up front, Mansa is in fact his title, and Musa was his name. Mansa has been translated as either king or emperor, but given that we call it the Mali Empire, I feel like the latter is much more fitting here. Mansa Musa is one of the several people throughout the past that has been given the illustrious title, Richest Man in All of History. Now, it's impossible to say how much wealth Mansa Musa actually had during his life. Actual numbers are dubious at best, considering the guy lived about 700 years ago. If you were to ask the internet, though, they give you the number $400 billion. Granted, that number came from an article in 2012. Given inflation in 2024, that would be almost $550 billion. For comparison's sake, Elon Musk's net worth is a bit less than $200 billion, making Mansa Musa well over twice as rich. But like I said, we don't know for sure. That could be grossly overestimating or even grossly underestimating his total wealth. And it's the story of how Mansa Musa used that ridiculous amount of money that we'll be looking at. Now, he didn't live in some sort of El Dorado paradise where the streets were paved with gold. No, he lived in a place much more interesting from a realistic perspective, the Mali Empire, a thriving region in medieval Western Africa that became an important hub for the Islamic world of this era. Mansa Musa would use his wealth to help support the spread of Islam, as well as prove that his homeland was just as important for the faith as cities like Mecca and Cairo. Under his rule as Mansa of Mali, his empire would reach its peak in terms of political prestige and control of its territories. Much of his influence and many of his construction projects are still felt today and seen throughout the former territory of his empire, whether it's any number of the mosques he ordered to be built, or the knowledge of places he brought under his control, such as the important trade hub of Timbuktu. There's plenty of story to be told about this man and his desire to see Mali put on the map. So, without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to the Empire of Mali in the early 14th century in From Hajj to Timbuktu. In the background history lesson, we'll take a look at two topics, the spread of Islam in Africa and the rise of the Mali Empire. As the religion of Islam was a very important factor in Mansa Musa's life, it only makes sense that we look into how his empire was brought into the Muslim sphere of influence. Obviously, Islam got its roots starting in modern-day Saudi Arabia. It spread into the African continent fairly early on. When early followers of Islam were being persecuted, the Prophet Muhammad, aka the founder of the religion, told his followers to seek safety in the kingdom of Aksum, which was located on both sides of the Red Sea in the southern Arabian Peninsula and northeastern Africa. Islam first started flourishing in the Ethiopian Empire, with the first mosque in Africa claimed as the Mosque of the Companions in Eritrea. In the mid-7th century, the Rashidun Caliphate began conquering northern Africa, first in Egypt and then slowly spreading west. The Umayyad Caliphate, the caliphate that succeeded the Rashidun Caliphate, continued its conquest of northern Africa. By the early 8th century, the Umayyads had managed to spread Islam into modern-day Morocco and cross the Strait of Gibraltar into Spain. Modern-day Morocco would prove to be a massive boon to the spread of Islam. It was then under the power of the Berber dynasty of the Almoravids. The Almoravids were an important waypoint in trade between places like Egypt and the region that would eventually become the Mali Empire. When the Almoravid kings converted to Islam, it only made sense that the religion would also travel down the Senegal River into places like Mali. So let's now shift focus into talking about Mali. Well, before we talk about Mali, we have to talk about Ghana. And no, not the modern-day nation of Ghana, but the Ghana Empire, which surprisingly did not have any land in the modern-day nation that shares its name. The Ghana Empire's origins are said to be within the 2nd to 4th centuries CE. Oddly, medieval Muslim historians claim that the original kings of the Ghana Empire weren't indigenous Africans, aka not black. However, also by the medieval era, meaning after Islam was brought to the region, the rulers of Ghana were claiming descendants from the family of Muhammad. Well, I think both of those options are wrong, especially the latter, considering Muhammad lived several centuries after the empire was formed. It doesn't change the fact that the Ghana Empire made a big name for itself early on. It was located along the Sahel, the region in Africa that acts as a transition zone between the Sahara Desert and the greener savannas and jungles of Central and Southern Africa. It was ripe with gold that could be traded for all kinds of wealth and power. With the introduction of the camel to Western Africa in the 3rd century, Ghana was unstoppable. You could easily trade from the Atlantic coast of Western Africa, go up the Niger River, connect to the Senegal River, and then ride a camel all the way to places like Egypt. With the rise of the Almoravids to their north, it's been theorized that the Ghana Empire started to decline due to their influence in the region, though it's heavily debated as to whether the Almoravid dynasty ever actually held power in Ghana. The Sahel also began drying up, resulting in weakening of the region overall. By the late 11th century, the Ghana Empire had converted to Islam, which caused its vassal states to get a bit antsy. In the 13th century, around the year 1230, the people of Mali, which was one of the vassal states of Ghana, led an uprising. According to the 14th century Muslim scholar Ibn Khaldun, the people of Mali far outnumbered anyone else in the region. The uprising was said to be led by a man named Sundiata Keita, who would go on to become the first leader of the Mali Empire. Obviously then, the Mali uprising took control of the lands that had once belonged to the Ghana Empire. That meant that it also inherited all of the wealth Ghana had accrued during its millennia, give or take a couple centuries, of existence. All of that gold, all of that power in Western Africa. It was now in the hands of the Mansa of Mali. Musa, the future Mansa of Mali, was the grandnephew of Sundiata Keita. He was probably born in the very late 13th century or the early 14th century. His childhood is not documented at all. I shouldn't be surprised at this point in the show's run, too many historical figures have this problem, but I still always find it annoying. Especially considering Musa would later employ scholars to tell his story, it's surprising that he gave us nothing about himself from before his rule. Or at least nothing has survived. Granted, Mali had thrived via oral tradition. Maybe it didn't matter to him at the time because it would have already been known. But even then, some random Muslim scholar should have recorded it anyways. But moving aside, it's clear that Musa's ascension to the throne was a bit contested. His father was never the Mansa, as the role had traveled down the mostly direct line of Sundiata Keita. According to Musa himself, the previous Mansa, which we know to be a man named Muhammad ibn Ku, decided to go on an exploration trip across the Atlantic Ocean. This would allegedly be the second time Mansa Muhammad had called for an oceanic expedition, though he had not joined in on the first one. Upon his departure, he called for Musa to act as the temporary Mansa to oversee things in Mali. When Mansa Muhammad conveniently never returned, Musa fully took over the empire as the new leader. For the most part, Mansa Musa's tale of his ascendancy is very much scrutinized by modern historians. It's widely believed that this was just a narrative he developed in order to make it seem like he peacefully took control when, no doubt, he simply usurped the throne by force. It's believed that Musa was in his early 20s when he fully took power in Mali. He was probably born and raised in the Muslim faith, as had become commonplace for the nobility of Mali at this point in time. However, many of the regular citizens within his empire still practiced local religions. And as a very devout Muslim, Musa saw it as his religious purpose to complete the Hajj. The Hajj is a pilgrimage, usually stated as mandatory, that Muslims must make at least once in their life, from wherever they live to the city of Mecca, the holiest city in Islam. According to the Quran, the Hajj has its history with the prophet Abraham. In the story, Abraham is ordered by God to leave his wife, Hajar, and son, Ishmael, alone in the desert of what would eventually become the city of Mecca. Hajar desperately searched for water but was unable to find any. When she finally returned to Ishmael, she found him digging in the sand with one of his legs. Soon enough, a spring of water appeared from where he dug. When Abraham finally returned, God ordered him to build the Kaaba. The Kaaba is a large black stone structure that sits in the center of the Masjid al-Haram, and it is the holiest site in all of Islam. When Muslims pray, they are to face the Kaaba. According to the Quran, the site of the Kaaba would eventually become surrounded by pagan idols. In 630, Muhammad and his followers traveled from Medina to Mecca to re-establish the Kaaba for God. After he cleansed the site, he reconsecrated the building for God. In 632, he laid out the specific rituals that went into completing the journey, which included a week's worth of religious activities. From the beginning of Islam's existence in the medieval era, the Muslim caliphates would often sponsor trips for pilgrims to Mecca. These state-sponsored pilgrimages attracted thousands, and they would often have military guards in attendance to protect the pilgrims. Well, continuing with centuries of tradition, Mansa Musa decided that he would go on the Hajj, and he would make it the greatest Hajj anyone had ever seen. Despite the Mali Empire inheriting a great amount of wealth, Musa decided that he would need a lot more for his ideal Hajj. Musa took control of Mali sometime around 1312. He would not go on his Hajj until 1324, so there was a dozen years of rule before then. So what exactly did Mansa Musa get up to between 1312 and 1324? Well, mostly conquering his neighbors. With the number of slaves he would eventually come to own, Musa's 12 years of conquest were surely some of the most horrific years to be non-Malians, especially if you weren't from a kingdom under Muslim control. It's theorized that Musa enslaved roughly around 6,000 slaves each year. During his Hajj, in which Musa spoke quite a bit about how great he was, the Mansa declared that he had successfully conquered 24 cities and their surrounding territories from the time he was crowned until he left on his Hajj. That's essentially 2 cities per year of his rule, meaning that unless he had a couple really good years and conquered multiple cities, the Mali Empire was in a period of non-stop war under Mansa Musa. Now, a lot of Musa's biography is based on the words of Mansa Musa himself. How accurately he told his life story is unknowable. I mean, the guy wanted to paint the best possible picture of himself as both a devout Muslim and a great ruler. I won't call the guy an outright liar, but there was surely some embellishment on his part. And I'm not calling him a liar in saying he conquered less than 24 cities. I think he must have conquered a lot more but lowballed his conquests to not make himself seem like the king of conquests. Nevertheless, we do know that the entourage accompanying Musa on his Hajj was absolutely insane from a numbers perspective, both in terms of people and the amount of gold and fine goods he traveled with. I'll get into those specifics in just a moment. So, in order to get all those slaves and resources, surely he had to do a great swath of conquering. But by the time he was done conquering Western Africa and expanding his empire, it was finally time for Musa to set out on his Hajj. Like I said, he set out in 1324. While he was gone, Musa's son Magan would be left in charge of the empire. Traveling with the Musa were 60,000 other men, each said to be dressed in the finest clothing made of gold and silk. Also accompanying that group was 12,000 slaves, which makes me beg the question, why did he enslave so many people before if he was only going to bring 12,000? I know enslaving people is part of building an empire, but like, okay, this is gonna sound weird, but why enslave so many people and then bring so few on your grand tour de force? Anyways, each slave carried a bar of gold that was said to weigh roughly 4 pounds, 1.8 kilograms. Heralds also carried golden flags. 80 camels were brought along, each carrying bags of gold dust that weighed anywhere between 50 to 300 pounds. I feel especially bad for the camels with the larger loads of gold. This was a spare no expense kind of trip, as should be painfully obvious from Musa's choice of company. So, with that disgusting splay of wealth at his side, Mansa Musa set off for Mecca. According to Arabic sources from Musa's lifetime, each Friday of his long journey, Musa ordered for a mosque to be built. This would serve to remind the people that, 1, Musa was a staunch advocate of Islam, but more importantly, 2, the Mansa was richer than God and had about as much authority to match. I don't actually know how long it took Musa to get to his first stop on his long journey, the Egyptian city of Cairo, but he arrived there in July in 1324. I saw one source saying he embarked in March, which would make it about 4 months of travel. Even a lowball estimate of his time traveling, with a mosque being built every Friday, would result in at least 15 mosques being built, which is an insane amount of construction to be doing while you're crossing the Sahara Desert. Other sources are much more generous and say he left in July and arrived in Cairo in the same month. But cross the Sahara into Cairo, Musa did. At this point in time, Egypt was under the control of the Mamluk dynasty. The Mamluks took control of Egypt in the mid-13th century after the collapse of the Ayyubid Sultanate, which was founded by famous crusade figure Saladin. The current ruler of Mamluk Egypt was Sultan al-Nasir Muhammad. Al-Nasir had a weird reign where he was technically Sultan of Egypt 3 different times, though that's not a story for this episode. He was currently in his 3rd reign. Al-Nasir had possibly met a previous Mansa of Mali who attempted the Hajj, Mansa Sakra, who had ruled 3 Mansas before Musa took power. According to Ibn Khaldun, Sakra died while returning from his Hajj and was the 2nd Mansa to attempt it, the first being Sunjata Keita's son, Mansa Uli. Granted, Al-Nasir was about 15 years old when Mansa Sakra originally made the Hajj, so how much interaction they actually had is unknown. Anyways, Musa decided that he would meet with the Sultan of Egypt in order to introduce/strengthen diplomatic ties between the 2 Islamic nations. However, when Musa approached the Sultan, he refused to bow before Al-Nasir. After a bit, he did eventually decide to bow, but Musa claimed he was only bowing before God, not the Sultan. Musa and his entourage, along with their boatload of gold, would stay in Cairo for 3 months. During this time, Musa spent so much money that he caused mass inflation in Egypt, devaluing Egyptian gold by 25%. He also befriended other Egyptian politicians during this time and taught them about his home country. He even stayed by the Great Pyramids of Giza for a few days. But after making some new friends and absolutely destroying the economy of Egypt, Musa decided it was time to continue his journey to the end goal. So, in the middle of October, the grand caravan of Mansa Musa's Hajj continued on to Mecca. When Mansa Musa arrived in modern-day Saudi Arabia, he continued much of the behavior he had practiced in Egypt. His entourage spent a ridiculous amount of wealth in both the cities of Medina and Mecca. While in the homeland of Islam, Musa started formulating plans on how to make Mali an even better Islamic nation. He appreciated the local architecture and met with local scholars. But Musa's time in Mecca was not entirely peaceful and spent worshipping and living up in luxury. Apparently, while in the Masjid al-Haram, Musa's entourage got into a fight with pilgrims from Turkey. Musa managed to smooth things over though before people actually started attacking each other. Also, all of the money spending finally caught up with the Malians. That being said, Musa and his entourage did not leave Mecca until the next year came around. By the time the Mansa arrived in Cairo, many of the members of the Malian Hajj crew had died from lack of food, the freezing desert nights, and bandit raids. Musa and his pals had to sell back much of the finery they had purchased during the Hajj in order to make enough money back to continue the trip home. However, when Sultan al-Nasir heard of Musa's problems, he decided to help out his fellow nobleman and gave Musa lavish gifts that could help restock his wealth. When Musa continued on the long road home, he set up propaganda campaigns to persuade scholars and artists from around the Muslim sphere of influence to come to Mali. Well, Musa had obviously made a name for himself during the Hajj, and many Muslim scholars decided to take him up on the offer. But word of his wealth and power spread even further than northern Africa and the Middle East. In 1375, a Catalonian scholar in Spain created a map of the known world at the time. As far as Western Africa goes, a large figure of a king with a golden crown and holding a big chunk of gold bears the inscription. This black lord is called Musa Meli, which I'm assuming is just the Catalan for Mansa Musa, and is the sovereign of the land of the black people of Guineva, the Catalan word for Ghana, which technically not wrong but also not correct. This king is the richest and noblest of all these lands due to the abundance of gold that is extracted from his lands. Mansa Musa had become a modern-day symbol of insane wealth and power. Okay, modern for the medieval era, at least. However, something else very important would happen between Cairo and Musa's arrival back home. In 1325, Mansa Musa would conquer the city of Timbuktu. Timbuktu's origins are still somewhat murky. For the most part, it's generally considered fact that it was made into a permanent settlement around a couple centuries before Mansa Musa gained power. Previously, it's believed that the site where Timbuktu sits was once a spot one of the many nomadic people who caravanned back and forth across the Sahara would stay during the summer months. Its spot in modern-day Mali is rather strategic, as it's just a few miles away from a major bend in the Niger River. As trade continued to flourish, especially with Islam peaking its way further south, it only seemed natural to create a permanent trade post in that spot. The trade post grew until it became a city. As the city was a safe place for travelers of all kinds, especially those caravanning through the Sahara, it only made sense that Islam would eventually plant its roots in Timbuktu. I haven't really mentioned it yet, but Islam really found its footing within the world of business. The Middle East was a massively important spot geographically, as it lay along the historical Silk Road, the trade route from Europe to Eastern Asia. It would remain that way until Europeans grew tired of dealing with the Middle East and built good enough boats to sail around Africa. But in the meantime, that meant that the Middle East, aka the cornerstone of the Muslim world, was filled with trade hubs and business-savvy individuals. When basically all of these merchants converted to Islam, they took the religion across the trade routes. It eventually just became easier for the people they were trading with to convert to Islam because it helped secure better working relationships, therefore making Islam the religion of the medieval business world, at least in Africa and Asia. So Mansa Musa, who I'm sure thought of himself as the world's best and most powerful Muslim, would clearly want to get his hands on an important city such as Timbuktu. And like I said, in 1325 he would have his wish. By all historical accounts, Musa peacefully annexed the city into his empire. I mean, he was a Muslim ruler and would greatly help expand trade within Timbuktu, therefore granting the city a higher level of prestige. And prestige indeed Mansa Musa brought to Timbuktu. He sought to make it a shining city for the world of Islam that would emulate his desire to put the Western Africa variety of Islam on the map. One of his first major projects for the city was to elevate three mosques in the city into madrasas, which are Islamic centers for education. In this particular instance, Musa's ideas would see the madrasas act as high-level universities for the Muslim world. Many of the scholars Musa convinced to immigrate from Egypt and the Middle East set up shop in Timbuktu, which elevated the city into one of the greatest Muslim hotspots in the entire world. It was Western Africa's version of the great cities of ancient times such as Babylon and Alexandria, Egypt. Heck, it even had libraries that would put the Library of Alexandria to shame. And Timbuktu would even survive the downfall of the Mali Empire, being inherited by the Songhai Empire who took over. It wasn't until 1591, when the Moroccans conquered the Songhai Empire, that Timbuktu finally entered into an age of decline. The Moroccans had the local scholars put to death for perceived disloyalty. That, combined with Europe finally starting to sail around Africa, made Timbuktu mostly obsolete. And yet, the city still survives. You can still see the mosques that were built and elevated to new heights under Mansa Musa. And even though Mali itself experiences struggles, Timbuktu itself has been held under complete siege by the JNIM Islamic Military Group, the absolute majesty of the city still remains standing. And God, I hope it continues to stand for centuries to come, to remind us of the importance of cities where knowledge can come from any corner of the world in order to create places where learning takes top priority. Let's get back to Mansa Musa in Mali. Like in Timbuktu, Musa set up places of education and Muslim scholarship throughout his empire. He continued to promote his homeland as a place where Islam could have a renaissance of sorts. Even outside of Timbuktu, it wasn't that rare a sight to see scholars from Egypt, Saudi Arabia, or even Spain. Under Mansa Musa, the Mali Empire is said to have entered its golden age of existence. That statement has been a bit disputed in more recent years, suggesting that it was only perceived as a golden age because Mansa Musa's reign is the best recorded of all the Mansas of Mali. However, it cannot be denied that Musa and his two successors, his son Maghan and his brother Suleiman, Mali was at its peak in terms of territorial control. And for what it's worth, Mali was technically in a literal golden age under Musa if you consider the vast amounts of gold he flaunted during his Hajj. He certainly had a solid goal in mind and absolutely nailed it. It's no wonder that when he passed away around 1337, historians immediately started saying that Mali entered into a period of decline. How do you live up to the guy who traveled across the Sahara with gold bars and created one of the greatest cultural melting pots in Western Africa? It also didn't help that starting just a few decades after his death, Mali started breaking apart and was threatened from the outside. Musa had been able to expand and protect his empire. His life was legendary even in its own time, and even centuries after his death, his name is used by the Mande people, an ethnic group who live in Western Africa, as a byword for anyone going on a pilgrimage. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. Next time, we're jumping through history to the Renaissance in England as we talk about one of the most famous queens of Europe, Elizabeth I of England. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.